refugees to stage cultural assaults against Islam and Muslims. The most recent scheme of the Western Zionism against Islam was the forging of terrorist groups in disguise of Islam. These animalistic groups had nothing to do with the teachings of the Prophet of Islam and the Noble Quran. In such circumstances, there have been two opposite currents with opposite functions. One is the current whose ultimate goal is to foment religious, sectarian, ethnic, and language differences to make Muslims and humans suspicious of one another and pave the way for bigger colonialist goals of the global arrogance and Zionism. The other current is built up of reformers who call on humans and Muslims to converge around commonalities, get united and abandon petty differences. The seditionist current is clearly supported by the domineering system. This system employs direct and indirect methods to cause rifts among Muslims. In the direct method, the statesmen and media of colonialist powers fight unity of Islamic sects and thoughts directly, while in the indirect method, they hire ignorant elements and urge them to indulge in acts that bold difference and arouse sectarian sentiments. The efforts to depict Wahhabism and Salafism as Islam are all made to this end. Along seditionist moves of Westerners and Zionists to sow discord among Muslims, the tendency toward unity that had started decades ago was accelerated by Imam Khomeini's move and the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In view of this, when some of the European media insulted the Prophet of Islam, tens of millions of Muslims in different countries staged demonstrations against the move. This showed that the Islamic Ummah is alive and wakeful. Furthermore, the Islamic solidarity with the people of Palestine, especially on the World Oath Day, and Islamic nation's sympathy and solidarity with the defenseless peoples of Yemen, Bahrain, Afghanistan, Kashmir, Myanmar, etc., clearly show that the Islamic Ummah is monolithic and united. The enemies of Islam, through highlighting Islamophobia and Iranophobia, is seriously seeking to wedge between Islam and the West, as they know that the Western youth are knowing Islam despite all efforts to besmirch the bright image of this religion. The Western media are trying to hinder the way of Islam into Europe and among non-Muslims. That's why they publish blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet and distort and ridicule the teachings of the Noble Quran. This method is reminiscent of the measures of ignorant Bedouins in the first years of Islam who would try to ridicule the Prophet. The enemies of Islam think that if they tarnish the image of their Prophet, Muslims would gradually abandon their religion, but they should know that they will never be successful. The history bears witness that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is the perpetual role model of human perfection, goodwill, peace, and justice, not just for Muslims, but for the whole mankind. Islam stresses solidarity of its followers. The Noble Quran, on the one hand, calls on Muslims to stick to unity and cling to God's cord, and on the other hand, prevents them from severing the bonds of affection and solidarity. Here, we pray for all those who tried for unity among Islamic denominations, particularly the great reformer and enemy of global arrogance and Zionism, Imam Sayyid Ruhollah Musavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who spent his life for this sacred goal. Thank you.
United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001. I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States' involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. For these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers, or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
Battle at Home. Part 1.
In November 2010, the U.S. Army charged five soldiers from its 5th Stryker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice. And sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served. And by that, I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Stryker 5 case. As the Stryker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of three Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted-for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted two farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock, Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes, reposition. Now, at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot-high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest, and he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. It went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and it lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down!" and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which of course we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year, and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition. And he left his post, and he went over to another area in the unit, and walked through that area. He went, opened one tent. He threw. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade. Fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, 2 or 3 times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for the initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Had graduated from college, didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq. And the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not, he was not capable, he was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD, and it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. We've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical, some critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, it was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds, or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo, and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image: American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts, and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, the gentlemen, the gloves are coming off, along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as the gloves are coming off suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied.
Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out, "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior? The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception. But just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that, when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, these guys started losing it. The battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I got to tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot three times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than three times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served three or four tours, sometimes back to back.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We also celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all of our listeners throughout the world on this very auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
Colin Powell, who was a military leader and key strategist of an empire that killed countless people and undermined the sovereignty of multiple nations, has died at the age of 84. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Coeli, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Colin Powell, Who Helped George W. Bush Lie Nation into Iraq War, Dies. Stay tuned for more. Colin Powell, the former U.S. Secretary of State who helped President George W. Bush, under whom he served to sell the 2003 invasion of Iraq to the United Nations and the American people, has died at the age of 84. According to the New York Times, he died of complications from COVID-19, his family said in a statement. He was fully vaccinated and was treated at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, his family said. In 2003, Powell, a retired four-star U.S. Army general who also served as chairman of the Joint Chiefs before becoming the nation's top diplomat under Bush, made the now infamous presentation to the UN Security Council, in which he claimed that the Iraqi government of President Saddam Hussein was hiding a secret chemical weapons program from the international community and supporting international terrorists following the 9/11 attacks of 2001. Powell later claimed that the testimony he gave in 2003 was a great intelligence failure. But critics, including his chief of staff at the time, Lawrence Wilkerson, said the speech was significant both for its dishonesty and that Powell's gravitas was a crucial part of the two-long-year effort by the Bush administration to get Americans on the war wagon. That effort, Wilkerson wrote in 2018, led to a war of choice with Iraq, one that resulted in catastrophic losses for the region and the United States-led coalition, and that destabilized the entire Middle East. In a 2018 column detailing what the former Secretary of State knew and was saying privately at the same time he was selling the Iraq invasion to the U.S. public, The Intercept's John Schwartz wrote that Powell's loyalty to Bush extended to being willing to deceive the world, the United Nations, the Americans, and the coalition troops about to be sent to kill and die in Iraq. He's never been held accountable for his actions, and it's extremely unlikely he ever will be. Powell's friends in America tend to briefly note, in the soft glaze of his own regret, the most consequential act of his life. On February 5, 2003, Powell made a 76-minute speech to the United Nations Security Council in which he argued the Bush administration's case for invading Iraq. He insisted that Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein was overseeing a secret program to make weapons of mass destruction. Powell brandished satellite photos of what he confidently said were decontamination trucks, aluminum tubes, and other WMD paraphernalia. He even held up a vial that he said could contain anthrax. There was, of course, a big problem with all his assertions. They were lies. The intelligence behind his speech was the opposite of emphatic. It was false, manipulated, and fabricated. The trucks were just trucks. The tubes were just tubes. There was no anthrax. There was, more fundamentally, no reason to invade Iraq. Nonetheless, thanks to Powell's presentation, the Bush administration went ahead with his plans, and in the ensuing catastrophe, at least several hundred thousand Iraqis lost their lives, as well as more than 4,000 U.S. troops. Scholar and journalist Mark Lamont-Hill struck a similar balance in his assessment, said, at the personal level, Colin Powell was a military leader and key strategist of an empire that killed countless people and undermined the sovereignty of multiple nations. In our memorials, we must be honest about all of this.
Aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman, the fictitious city of Kaluts.
I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kaluts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Megadunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Megadunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kaluts or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kaluts area. Not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kaluts, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kaluts are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalud formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kaluds, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kaluds, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kaluds. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kaluds in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different kaluts or yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kaluts are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kaluts of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But, well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kaluts in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kaluts in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kaluts. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kaluts for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kaluts, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is, they're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kaluz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeved shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of glasses, sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles, too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kaluz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kaluz depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalutz Basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalutz with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as Kalate and Kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word Kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark. When on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone Kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Sirj Mountains back there towards the Kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This Kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the Kaluts, the winds are so strong, they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the Kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the Kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the Kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because